Good evening, America. Welcome to the Dave Campbell Show. We're working very hard to create the best talk radio that we can possibly create. For those of you that were following me before when I had my live radio show, I'd like to thank you for coming back to this entirely different format, which I think is going to be extremely exciting. For one thing, there won't be quite the breaks that happen on live radio. So it'll give us more time to talk to our guests and actually talk to you. If you'd like to join the conversation tonight, the call-in number is 1-877-572-1895. So I look forward to hearing you and possibly getting some chat comments. You can follow me on Twitter. Yes, I have a Twitter account at CampbellGRP@twitter.com. You can also send me an email at info@campbellmanagement.us or info@clarity-from-chaos.com. As you know, the people that used to follow me on live radio know, our show isn't about just reading what comes up on Drudge every day or the local news, but what we actually focus on a day-to-day or in show-to-show event is actually trying to come up with some solutions to some of these issues, not just talk about them and basically complain, which is, you hear a lot of. There's not a lot of solution sets out there, just a lot of rehashing the comments of the day. And this show is not about rehashing anything. It's actually trying to focus and clearing some of that chaos away and creating some clarity around some of these issues. So as was typically normal in my show that I had on live radio, I usually start the show out with a little bit of humor because we obviously need a little bit of humor these days. So let me start out with a pretty good joke, and I hope you will enjoy it. It's about a politician, and it goes something like this. While walking down the street one day, a corrupt senator, I know, that does sound redundant, was tragically hit by a car and died. His soul arrives in heaven, is met by St. Peter's at the entrance, and St. Peter says, "Welcome to heaven. But before you settle in, it seems there is a problem. We seldom see a high official around these parts, so we're not quite sure what to do with you." "No problem," says the senator. "Just let me in." "Well, I'd like to, but I have orders from the higher-ups." And we all know who the higher-ups are. "What we'll do is we'll have you spend one day in hell and one day in heaven, and then you can choose where to spend eternity." "Really? I've made up my mind. I want to be in heaven," says the senator. "I'm really sorry," said St. Peter's, "but we have our rules." And with that, St. Peter escorts him to the elevator, and down he goes. With that, the doors open, and he finds himself in the middle of a green golf course. In the distance is the clubhouse, and standing in front of the clubhouse are all of his friends. I can imagine. And other politicians he had worked with all of his life. Everyone is happy to see him. They're dressed to the nines, and they run up to greet him, shake his hand, and reminisce about the good times they had while getting rich at the expense of the people. They played a friendly game of golf, then dined on lobster, caviar, and the finest champagne. Also present is the devil, who is really a very friendly guy and who's having a good time dancing and telling jokes. They are all having such a good time that before the senator realizes it, it's time to go. Everyone gives him a hearty farewell and waves while the elevator rises. The elevator goes up and up, and once again the door reopens in heaven where St. Peter is waiting for him. "Now it's your time to visit heaven." So 24 hours pass, and the senators join the group of contented souls moving from cloud to cloud, playing the harp and singing and just having a general good time. Before he realizes it, the 24 hours have come and gone, and St. Peter's returns. "Well then, you've spent a day in hell and another in heaven. Now you choose your eternity." The senator reaches up and scratches his chin and reflects for a moment. "Well, never have I said it before. I mean, heaven had been delightful, but I think I would be better off in hell." So St. Peter's escorts him to the elevator, and down he goes. When the doors open, he sees nothing but barren land covered in waste and garbage. Sees all of his friends dressed in rags, picking up trash and putting it in black bags as more trash falls to the ground. The devil comes over to him, puts his arm around his shoulder. "But I don't understand," stammers the senator. "Yesterday I was here. There was golf, lobster, the clubhouse, caviar, the champagne, Everything was wonderful. Now it's a wasteland full of garbage, and my friends look miserable. What happened? The devil smiles at him and said, yesterday we were campaigning. Today you voted. So
that's a good one, Dave. That's a
I think that probably reminisces of where we're at. Sort of today. When I was prepping for the show, and by the way, we have a really, really great guest that will join us at the bottom of the hour, Mr. Josh Liebner, who wrote a fabulous book that I think you all are going to really enjoy. But while I was working up the prep for the show tonight, it occurred to me the word mediocrity kept bouncing in and out of my head, and I was somewhat surfing across the news media prior to coming on the show, and the word mediocrity kept coming back and forth and back and forth. And lo and behold, what do I see but the biggest Medicare fraud in history has been uncovered. Now, that's interesting to me because if you read the article, $375 million of your taxpayer money has been sequestered by apparently this doctor in Dallas who figured out a way to scam the system. But what intrigued me the most about the article was not about the indignation over the $375 million of your million dollars that have been kicked away, but this happened between 2006 and 2011. So a little bit on the last president's watch and a whole lot on the current president's watch. But when you read the article, there is no responsibility in the article. There is no responsibility over the fact that the government, due to their negligence and lack of oversight, allowed this to happen, which I kind of, you know, with today's mainstream media not wanting to point their finger at our current administration, this is kind of another along the lines of, you know, Fast and Furious and everything else. But it strikes me, and it kind of goes along with tonight's theme about mediocrity, is that here's another example of government waste, and nobody's really talking about it. I mean, they're patting themselves on the back over the fact that they uncovered this guy, but there's nothing mentioned in the article anywhere about the responsibility of the government to take any responsibility for the fact that they had no oversight on this. And I just kind of find that amazing, and it kind of goes along with some of the other research I did on this simple term of mediocrity. I pulled up an article that was dated February 15th of this year out of the Federal Business Daily, and the entire article is talking about the way the government goes and buys goods and services, and it's termed the lowest price technically acceptable. Nobody talks about the irony of what the cost to you and I are about lowest price technically acceptable. Now, I'm sure nobody listening tonight wants to get in an airplane and understand that it was built at the lowest price and it was technically acceptable. But they've demonstrated over the last three fiscal years that the use of this has basically cost you and I approximately 40% as an increase to buying goods and services. And holding a competition under what they term as LPTA terms can even result in ironic consequences. Not only can it drive up cost, but the people bidding on this work, and you can take this even to the local level here in Phoenix where we're broadcasting from. This is a rampant problem in the city of Phoenix with the way that they conduct their bid practices. But the offers elevate their prices to compensate for the risk, and even during periods of austere budgets and intense competition, it can lead to underpriced solutions as the bidders lowball their bids to win the business. And you see it constantly out there, especially in today's environment where it's just such a cutthroat environment on bidding that they will obviously come in and underbid lowest price, lost leader these jobs. And at the end of the day, you and I are getting, you know, diminished services, diminished quality, and everything else. So what the article...
Hey, well, Dave, it sounds horrible. It sounds like they're trying to rip us off from every way from sundown and nobody's paying attention. Is that what you're talking about with mediocrity?
Yeah. I mean, it's just it's a perfect example, Judy, of the mediocrity in government. Just like I pointed out in this Medicare thing, mediocrity has moved, you know, the oversight to the point where apparently this doctor in Dallas was able to basically steal $375 million out of Medicare and shuffle it down to the Grand Cayman Islands, and it took them 6 years to find this out. Now, as I said, none of the major news media has even discussed the fact that it took them six damn years to catch this guy, which tells me somebody's not paying attention. So that's an example of mediocrity. This lowest price, technically acceptable source selection method is an extremely good example of government's pursuit of mediocrity. And I think our current presidential candidates are talking about it. But if I'm not mistaken, there is only one presidential candidate that's talked about this at all, and that was Newt Gingrich. And Newt has mentioned on several occasions about bringing Six Sigma into the government to start cleaning up some of this stuff. My fear is I don't know that anybody really realizes the level of effort and discipline it's going to take to start knocking some of this down, because obviously it's pervasive. But the interesting thing is it also goes hat in hand with this entire effort over budget and our excess budget issues that we have in this country. I mean, we're talking in terms of trillions of dollars that this country is underwater from a debt standpoint, yet we have these practices that basically promote it. You know, if they caught one doctor in Dallas scamming the system for $375 million, I'm not quite sure that there aren't multiples of this doctor out there doing the same thing. They may be doing it at a smaller scale, but you could probably start adding up just a ton of these examples and probably clean a lot of the budget issues up if they would just clean up the mediocrity that's sitting around Washington. You know, as I mentioned on the Six Sigma stuff, Six Sigma basically is a quality control system that was, well, originally started with Malcolm Baldrige and a big effort in Japan when Japan was coming out of the Second World War. And you see it predominantly in Japanese industry, although it's really started to take hold here, and that's to take quality from, say, for example, 99.9% to 99.9999%, which means your errors are, you know, logarithmically smaller as you increase the quality around some of these processes. But my fear is, although Six Sigma would be great, and there's several other processes that the government could use, it's going to take an inordinate amount of discipline and people understanding just the level of complacency that is really costing them. I'm just wondering if the budget issue should be shifted to just the fact that Washington can't run itself in any kind of an efficient fashion. You know,
Dave,
I don't know.
You know, I was going to say, Dave, you're a project manager. I mean, you're an expert in this area. Why is it, do you think, that they allow this to go on without any media attention? I mean, this is absurd.
They're not going to get any media attention, Judy, because obviously the mainstream media is not going to, you know, I think if this had happened in Dallas with this Medicare scam, had popped up under George Bush's watch, excuse me, everybody would have been all over it. I mean, they'd have been crawling up poor George's legs with this whole issue, as opposed to today under Barack Obama. I mean, we're not even really hearing about what's going on Fast and Furious. I've got to imagine, you know, I read in the article that Health and Human Services, they were patting themselves on the back that their fraud task force had uncovered this particular instance. But my question is two things. One, there is no responsibility, there is no accountability in the article about the fact that they allowed this lack of oversight to create this situation. And number two, it took them six damn years to uncover it. I mean, this thing's been going on. I mean, the list of people indicted on this thing is extraordinary.
And the money is, as you said, is offshore. I mean, this is criminal activity, and it's getting no play. I'm outraged. Thanks, Dave, for bringing this up.
The funny thing is, and this is hilarious, the funny thing is that this was reported by all the major news outlets as $375 million, and the Washington Times reported it as $375 billion. Now, here you have a major news outlet that can't even report accurately the story. So I'm wondering if Media Matters is probably feeding them their information, and they got their B's and their M's mixed up on their keyboard, because, you know, it was very clear that the Washington Times reported is $375 billion, and every other major news outlet was $375 million. I mean, just common sense when you get to thinking about it. Somebody's scamming the government out of $375 billion.
That's the Senate.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's Congress.
That's a senator. That's,
that's Congress. That's, yeah, that's not some poor doctor in Dallas. Right. But it's just this whole term of mediocrity, it kind of keeps bouncing around. And the reason I'm talking about mediocrity is because our guest is coming on at the bottom of the hour. His entire book is dedicated to trying to clean up a lot of that stuff. It's a fabulous read, and I'm really looking forward to talking to him. And by the way, you're listening to The Dave Campbell Show on Blog Talk Radio. And if you'd like to join in to the discussion, the call-in number is 877-572-1895. Really look forward to hearing from you and maybe participating in the discussion. But real quickly, what I would like to do before our guest comes on is go through five ways to ensure. This is to ensure mediocrity is in your organization. This is five ways to ensure it. First, if you desire a mediocre workforce, you make sure your employees know you don't trust them. Now, I think the government probably makes sure that they don't trust their employees. I mean, obviously, we hear that almost on a daily basis. Number two is if you want to drive talented people away, you don't tell them when they're doing well. You just kind of expect them to be there and so on and so forth. Number three is if you prefer a team of C-list players, keep your employees in the dark. Now, it would seem to me that that's, you know, been relative pervasive not only in the government, but relatively pervasive in a lot of workplaces that I've been in. From a consulting standpoint, I see it almost every day. So, again, you know, it's this whole term of mediocrity, and I know from a consultant standpoint, it drives consultants nuts. We have to be somewhat careful over it because it's also what keeps consultants employed, because consultants tend to not be mediocre and tend to come in and try to fix this mediocre attitude. Here's number four, is if you value docility over ingenuity, shout it from the rooftops. Now, I think this one, interestingly enough, part of that is caused by today's economic condition, because I think people are hesitant to stick their heads above the hedges for fear of getting shot or for fear of getting laid off and everything else. So people, I think because the economy's been such a sad state of repair over the last, should I say, 3 years, since the current president took office. But I see it, like I said, I see it on a daily basis where, you know, people that are really trying to make a mark because of the economy and because of their fear of their job are very, very reluctant to say anything. Very, very reluctant. And therefore, you know, you're not getting what you really need. And, you know, there's a couple of examples where an MBA individual joined a manufacturing company and went to call a meeting and said, was basically told that he was not authorized to call meetings because it was against company policy, because he wasn't high enough up on the totem pole to call a meeting or to provide any leadership. So we're hiring you for your talent. Now go do something brilliant. Just doesn't happen anymore. And number five, which is a great one. Number five is perfect. It's if you fear, and I love this one, if you fear an empowered workforce more than you fear the competition, squash any sign of individualism. Now, I see that on a daily basis, Judy. I'm sure as a teacher you see that on a daily basis.
I think you're right. I mean, I think you've described the workplace, Dave.
Well, it is the workplace.
The workplace to a T. I mean, it is mediocre.
It absolutely is. And after we get done talking to Josh tonight, we'll spend some time on how you can fix this mediocrity within your own sphere of influence, which Josh goes into great detail in his book. he talks about it a great deal, and obviously when Josh comes on here in a few minutes, we'll be able to really dive into it. But I just wanted to give the audience out there this sense of mediocrity, and that it does not have to be something that people are satisfied with. It's something that should be fought tooth and nail. And quite frankly, settling for the mediocrity, like we were talking about earlier, in the government, as far as I'm concerned, contributory to the debt crisis that we have. Because I'm sure, as well as I'm sitting here with my wonderful dogs wrapped around my feet and discussing this with you, that if we cleaned up just half of the efficiencies in the government, then a lot of this debt would become a non-issue. And I've already cited a perfect example where we just lost $375 million into the Cayman Islands, which I'm sure we'll never see again. And God knows how many other people are in the same business as this doctor in Dallas.
Dave, it looks like we have Josh on the line. So if you want to introduce him, I'll bring him on board the Dave Campbell Show, the Dave Campbell Train.
Everyone, I would like you to raise your hands and give a big welcome to Mr. Josh Liebner. He is the co-author of the book, The Power of Strategic Commitment. He co-authored it along with Gershon Mader and Mr. Alan Weiss. Josh and Gershon were the co-founders of Quantum Performance Incorporated. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Thank you very much, Dave.
It's a fabulous book. I've read it through twice now, and what I was talking about earlier for the audience was I was talking about mediocrity and how your book addresses a major component in that regard. Why did you write the book, just out of curiosity?
Well, we've worked with probably 100,000 people over the last 25 years, and there's all different kinds of consulting that can be done, you know, IT consulting, human resource consulting, financial engineering consulting, and we found that one of the things that we've had some success at, or quite a bit of success at, and one of the things that is sorely missing in organizations is environments where people can genuinely express their commitment and be fulfilled and have that commitment actually shape the destiny of an organization. So it's, you know, we spend too much time at work and toiling away at whatever our jobs are for work to not be satisfying. And when people can't express their commitment and have that commitment be fulfilled, you know, there's suffering or apathy or resignation that sets in, and there's just too much of that in the world. So that was, you know, our intent is to help people be more fulfilled at work and have companies be more successful and you know, to do good things.
Well, I, you know, personally, I think you did a great job. And, you know, just starting in chapter one of your book where you talk about commitment trumps compliance, I think most companies, and as a consultant, as a project manager, I've run, you know, really large programs and stuff like that, but I have yet, just as your book points out, I've done consulting for some of these clients. And interestingly enough, everything that you talk about in here, you know, is basically points a finger at them. And, you know, one of the interesting things is right off the bat, you talk about commitment trumping compliance. And so many of these companies are hung on compliance.
Yes.
And there's little that they talk about as far as commitment.
It's interesting because I think people believe that compliance is kind of as high as you get. And obviously we're not talking about merely regulatory compliance or
right,
you know, complying with laws. That's a given.
Right.
We're talking about it, kind of a mood or a spirit or tone of mere compliance where, you know, people after work sit with each other and grumble because their boss made them do something or
right,
because the board is making me do something. Because we even hear that at CEO levels, that you know, a mood of compliance even at the CEO level that the politicians or the regulators or the industry or, you know, somebody out there is making me do what I have to do every day. And the difference between that and a what you often see in a volunteer organization. So I happen to sit on a couple of boards of some local volunteer organizations where people are there because they want to be, because they're committed to making a contribution. And, you know, they get no they get rewards other than monetary, but there's a kind of a sense of satisfaction and a sense of making a difference that if you can inject even small amounts of that into the corporate world, you get an unbelievable return on in terms of people's productivity, in terms of their performance, in terms of their satisfaction, and in terms of the performance of the organization. I mean, I can't imagine, and I haven't done work with Apple Computer, but I just can't imagine that walking around the halls of Apple Computer or the cubicles, that there's a mood of compliance. It's a mood and a spirit of we're going to change the world and we're going to do something amazing. And I just use Apple because
it's very visionary, and I think they probably have created, and Apple's one of the, you know, obviously from a product standpoint, you know, they're starting to bury their competitors just with their innovation, and the things that they're doing.
Imagine if most companies had as many evangelists as customers as Apple does.
Right.
You know, if somebody drove a Chevy or a Ford or whatever, and just raved about their car, wouldn't that be amazing? You know, you spend so much less on advertising and all that. It's just, you know, the knock-on effects are amazing when you get an environment of commitment.
Right, and not to get completely hung on Apple, but being in the IT industry, I hear every day people wishing that the business environment hadn't got hung on Microsoft and had gotten hung on Apple, because the two products are like the difference between a Volkswagen and a Porsche.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, to be fair, I'm sure there's plenty of people at Microsoft.
Oh, I'm sure there are.
I have some friends who work there, absolutely passionate and committed. So I think the key for us over the last 25 years, as I said, is we've found people in many companies, even if the company was in an old-fashioned, you know, mature industry, who are passionate and committed and realistic. You know, they're not passionate because they're lunatics. They're passionate because they genuinely believe in whether it's an IT reengineering project or developing a new product, whatever it is that they're doing, or simply, you know, there's a story in the book. I forget which chapter. I happen to stop at a filling station, you know, somewhere here in New Jersey, and because I had to use the washroom, and I was not expecting an enjoyable time, right?
I've been on that road.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I walked in the washroom and it was clean and everything was filled. And this was not a brand new station. This was just a regular corner gas station, not a big rest area or anything. And I came out and I said to the attendant, you know, wow, your facilities are really nice. And the guy said, yeah, well, I really like to make sure that things work well for our customers. And I said to him, how long have you owned this place? And he said, I'm not the owner. I just work here. I just like to do a good job. And it struck me that you don't have to be a general manager of a plant. You don't have to be a vice president. You could be the ticket taker at the movie theater. You could be the filling guy at the filling station. You could be the checkout line at the grocery store. We really do have choices about how we interact. And, you know, when people are operating in an environment of commitment, like we said, it just absolutely trumps an environment where people are merely doing what they have to do to collect their paycheck.
Well, I agree with you, and I had a thought, but I'm gonna wait just a little bit to bring it up. But this issue of outsourcing that you have under the commitment versus compliance, I was fascinated because most people don't. It seems to be one of the outsourcing seems to be a word, as you point out in your book, is a comic metaphor, but you know it's being used more and more. And from a PM standpoint, where I deal with trying to get, you know, disparate teams all in the boats where they're not in rowing the same direction, to where we're not going around in a circle, and because of diversity and geographic location, everything else, is becoming harder and harder to do. Most people don't like to talk about outsourcing, and I found it refreshing to see it in your book.
Yes, it's a key issue these days. I think, you know, there's a lot of myths about what is it that determines how committed people are to the success of an organization.
Right.
So one of those myths is that pay is directly linked to performance, because the formulas are easy to line up. And the problem is that it's just not true. If only it were true. You know, mm-hmm. Then if you wanted 25% more performance, you'd figure out, you know, what's the exact amount of money, and 99% of the time it would work. Problem is, it works a lot less than 99% of the time, because there's so many other things that influence people, whether it's politics, and I mean organizational politics, or turf, or ego, or, you know, all those things that affect human beings. So, and one of the myths is that departments or functions that are outsourced and report up to a boss somewhere else, and therefore collect their pay
right.
somewhere else, are going to be less committed to the goals of the organization, you know, to the organization that they are providing services to. And it's just not necessarily true. I've seen organizations come together for an event, you know, a concert or a large conference. I've seen organizations where people report, one guy reports up to operations, another guy to sales, another guy to R&D, another guy to finance. And they come together when they actually feel that they're part of building something together, when the mission is clear, and when they feel like they have some say about that and a voice in that. And people will go above and beyond, and their pay, their concern about their pay, starts to be subordinated to their concern about succeeding. Ironically, in those kinds of situations, ultimately the performance of that group is much better. So, you know, hopefully their pay ends up being better, but it's just not a one-for-one. So I think outsourcing is a key. I think there are ways to work with outsourced areas to make them feel absolutely connected to the mission of an organization.
Oh, I would agree, because I deal with matrixed organizations all the time, and I had the same conversation with a fellow program manager today, where she was lamenting certain aspects of project management, and I just pointed out to her that good project program managers do just exactly what you're talking about. It's not so much the technology of project management, it's more about having the proper people skills to not only sell the vision, but to motivate your team to where everybody is in agreement with what you're trying to get done.
Yes.
And, you know, at that point, you know, if you can create an environment in your project with your team that's safe enough for people to, for lack of a better term, let their hair down and actually let the creative forces go, it just works like magic.
And you know, it's great that you're saying that. There's a famous parable of the Zen monk walking down the path, and he comes upon two fellows. They're a few feet apart. And he says to one, "What are you doing?" And the fellow looks up, because he's got a hammer and a chisel in his hand. He says, I'm chipping stone. I'm breaking stone." And he walks a few feet to the other one. He says, "And what are you doing, my son?" And he says, and he's doing the exact same thing with a hammer and a chisel. He says, "I'm building a cathedral." So you can only imagine that the output and the awareness of possible mistakes and the degree to which he dealt, you know, with care and concern from the second fellow was a whole order of magnitude beyond what the first one was, even though their actions in the moment, you know, from distance, looked to be exactly the same. So when we talk about commitment, we talk about, you know, I know it's a bit poetic, is we want people want to be building cathedrals. There's something much more satisfying about building a cathedral than chipping stone. Even though the way you build a cathedral, you know, you got to have a bunch of stones.
Chip the stone, exactly. Right.
So people have to, you know, in what you're talking about, people do have to write code. And they have to debug, and they have to, you know, all those things.
Yeah, all the tedious stuff. But if they have the vision and the project manager is successful in creating and instilling that vision, then writing the code tends to knit it all together.
We supported the largest private sector IT reengineering project. This was about 3 or 4 years ago, inside one of our major clients. And the story's in the book, but. You know, I won't mention it here.
Right.
And it was 2.5 years, $500 million, and give or take 2,000 to 2,500 internal and external people working on it over that period of time. And when the CIO of the organization kind of recognized some of these things we're talking about, and just an amazing executive, when he started the project, he kicked it off by having a fellow who had climbed Mount Everest come and talk to the top 150, 200 people in the group about the kinds of challenges that it takes and the kind of logistical effort and what it means to hang together and look out for each other and just a massive effort of coordination and you can't give up and all those things. And because for him, it was an Everest-sized project. And he wanted people to really get a feel for that this was not just about the tedium and the long hours and, you know, all the hard work it was going to take that because somebody, one of his souls had said, you know, I feel like we're about to go on a death march.
Yeah.
So his intent was to create a different frame for it, right? Which is cathedral building, Everest climbing, you know, whatever poetic term you want to use.
Yeah, I mean, whatever kind of visual aids that you can bring to it that people can kind of hold on to, you know.
Exactly, because when you walk around the cubicles, they're sitting at their keyboards writing code.
Right.
But it's not because the name of the game is we're here to write code. We're here to, and actually the vision they crafted for their project, and it was very simple, was to build the infrastructure to power innovation. So it was... Which every single person could connect to, whether they were working on the very technical hardware aspects of it, or they were writing on some of the more esoteric developmental stuff. So it was really cool, and it energized people. And you know, he did things like on Friday afternoons he'd push the drink cart around, you know, the refreshment cart around. But it was because they were in it together, not because he read some book that said you need to, you know, do these gestures. So it wasn't about gestures. It was about we're in this together.
Let me ask you, and this is the point where I kind of tabled my question that I was going to ask you. In your book, you're talking about consensus versus agreement.
Alignment.
Alignment, which I think... It's just fabulous because the word consensus has been, I mean, it's just another one of those corporate buzzwords again.
Yeah.
That you constantly hear is kind of like, you know, think outside the box kind of thing. You've got to have consensus. And your definition to reframe that is great. And maybe you could spend a few minutes talking about the difference.
Absolutely. Because it's one of the key principles of the kind of work we do. There's, you know, conventional wisdom, like you said, is consensus is kind of as good as it gets. So let's come to consensus. You hear that all the time.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And the problem is that you also hear people say things like, well, you know, let's agree to disagree.
Oh, yeah.
Because
that's
when you can't come to consensus, then let's agree to disagree, which really means it's really a polite way of saying if and when this thing gets screwed up, which we all know it always is going to, whether it's an hour later or a week later at the most, because things are moving too fast for whatever you decide today to be 100% relevant, you know, more than a week later anyway.
Right.
So it's code for saying when things screw up, I'm going to know whose fault it was, and whose fault it was is yours, because you didn't agree with what I wanted. So I'm going to – maybe I won't trumpet the fact that I told you so, but in my head and in my team, we're going to know that I told you so. Right, so that's the unsaid. but it shapes behavior. It shapes how quickly people respond and try and fix it. So I just have to read something. I think we have the quote in the book.
It's, oh, sure.
It's an unbelievable quote by Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, I'm sitting here looking at it.
Oh,
gosh.
Great. So Thatcher said, to me, consensus seems to be the process of abandoning all beliefs, principles, values, and policies in search of something in which no one believes but to which no one objects. The process of avoiding the very issues that have to be solved merely because you cannot get agreement on the way ahead. What great cause would have been fought for and won under the banner, I stand for consensus? So you just can't say it better than that, because I love how she talks about, you know, you're basically abandoning everything you believe in, everything you stand for, in search of something which is the lowest common denominator outcome that no one really cares about, but about which people can say, well, at least we have consensus. And in order to do that, you know, what she says is you have to avoid the very issues that have to be solved merely because you can't get agreement. And I think, I know this is not a political show, but I think our current political environment.
Oh, no, feel free, Josh. Feel free.
Well, you know, I just.
Yeah, I know.
It just couldn't be any more of a perfect example of exactly this. I mean, they can't even come to consensus, right?
No.
Now, alignment, on the other hand, and is an entirely different order of relationship to what it is you've agreed to. And believe me, this is very, very hard. I mean, I mentioned I'm on a couple of boards. So I'm on a board of a local volunteer organization, and we're trying to decide, should we change the hours that the organization is open on, you know, some particular holidays?
Right.
It's a religious
sure.
organization. And we have had 5 meetings with 6-7 people, and the amount of the difficulty, let me put it, in terms of people being willing to say, you know what, I came in really believing that we should go this way, but for the sake of the group, as long as we can do this and do this and, you know, move a little bit here, move a little left there, I'm willing to be 100% behind what this group decides, as long as, you know, we do these things. It's very, very hard for people to get there, because we have this view that, you know, the consensus is as good as it gets, but that the consensus really means everybody giving up what they believe in, so it becomes a sacrifice. Rather than for us to succeed, and this is what we work with organizations to generate, for us as a leadership team to succeed, we need to be 100% behind, each and every one of us needs to be 100% behind the outcome that we're aiming for. And it may take us 2 more weeks, 3 more weeks, another month to get there with each other. So for us to, you know, as Thatcher said, to us to deal with the very issues that need to be solved, whether they're personnel issues, whether they're product issues, whether they're expense issues. But once we get there, and I've done this with a lot of organizations, you know, you get the top 50, top 100 people in a large organization 100% behind something, it's unbelievable. And because you then don't have to police anybody, because everybody's on the same page. And all the gray issues that come up, and all the white space between people's accountabilities, because people will say things like, well, things aren't clear. The issue is not that we're not clear. It's that you don't have a shared commitment. When you have a shared
right.
commitment, you get clear, right? You
yep.
You figure things out together. Or you have each other's back so that if somebody does make a decision, that's your partner making a decision, you back them up.
So, you know, I'm just wondering, Josh, though, if part of, you know, the economic climate, I mean, you know, I remember back, God, I'm dating myself here, you know, I suffered through the Carter years. Then, you know, I did a lot of consulting work in the nuclear industry during the Reagan years, and it was, everybody I talked to during that time frame, it was such a joy of creativity.
Mm.
And I'm wondering if the some of this is because of the economic climate. I mean, you make a you know, a statement in the book about staying off the radar screen, and I made a statement earlier before you came on the show about don't rock the boat. I'm just wondering if a lot of people that would embrace this are keeping their heads down for fear of getting bounced out the door.
Yeah, but I think that's but in my experience, that's not because of the economic. That's not solely because of the economic environment. That's because that's how people are. You know, somebody said to me, this is 5 years ago, so, you know, things were really good economically. And I remember having a conversation with, it was a woman that I met on a project. And so, you know, how was your day, basically? She said, you know, today was great. No one asked me to do anything.
Huh.
And I thought, wow, that's just kind of remarkable. Because her relationship to the project that she was working on was basically, I want to do as little as is needed to not get in trouble. But that wasn't because she was afraid of losing her job. That's because that was all she was being asked for. You know, that the environment in at the place where she worked was one of just do what you need to do to get along. It wasn't we're going to be amazing. It wasn't we're going to be – I mean, to go back to Apple, you can't imagine a person like that surviving an Apple. Right?
No
one asked me to do anything. Because you know, from reading Steve Jobs' book or just hearing the stories that are out there, and I don't want to single out Apple. I'm sure it's that way at hundreds of companies, right, large and small. When leaders set the tone that the environment around here is going to be one where we do great things, and whether we, you know, whether it's a laundromat or a carpet, you know, manufacturer or GM, when the environment is one where the leaders set the tone of we're going to do great things, then people need to take risks. People need to step up. People need to have the courage to, you know, the courage of their convictions.
Right.
And there's always the risk that one could lose their job. So we're not advocates of being reckless by any means. But, you know, to have a modus operandi of I'm going to keep my head down and not rock the boat is—it's just not one that.
Well, yeah, I
fosters in a higher performing environment.
Yeah, yeah, and to me, it's just so—it's so adverse to the, you know, as a consultant, it's just completely adverse to me because my book of business is basically built on word of mouth, and you know, if I don't bring my A game every day and deliver, you know, exceptional things to an organization that I'm working with, I'm not working.
Exactly.
You know, so you know, I bring my, you know, the fact that I would be punching a time clock for the sake of punching a time clock is just foreign to me.
Yes.
But you know, as I was talking about before you came on the show, apparently, and I know, you know, as a consultant, mediocrity is somewhat where, you know, I garner my income is because, quite frankly, you know, it's a ripe environment because people have just, you know, gotten slovenly. I mean, to for lack of a better term, you know, they just kind of go along to get along. They've either lost their self-confidence, they've lost their hope, or something. I'm not quite sure, Josh.
Well, yeah, and I think that I agree. But I also think, and you know, you've done consulting, I do consulting, we also, you know, see environments where people that are amazing, right?
And absolutely.
Where it really is a high-performing environment, and then the challenge is, you know, how do we get even better? And there's a – I think that probably – you know, one of the things that strikes me is how different it is in different companies, which to – you know, because I'll occasionally, you know, be working in one company one day and another company the next.
Right.
Sometimes even in the same day, right, a meeting in the morning and a meeting in the afternoon. And the feel of the place can be entirely different. And on the one hand, it's I find myself, you know, kind of being critical. Like, don't they, you know, isn't this terrible? And Don't they see they can do something about it?
Right.
On the other hand, I think that's kind of a great it says to me that leaders really can make a difference very, very quickly. And they do not have to, you know, the environment is not given by the paint on the walls, and it's not given by the furniture. The environment is given by the leaders in that organization. And the kind of courage they display, the kind of candor they insist upon, the trust that they encourage and foster or discourage, or the
right.
distrust that they, you know,
yep.
the level of alignment that they insist upon and cultivate, or the degree to which they tolerate, you know, hallway conversations and people being apathetic and talking about the good old days or how bad it is. And leaders shape that every single day. And by leaders, also, we talk about this quite a bit in the book, I don't just mean people who have the title. Because I've seen people at relatively junior levels in organizations step up to lead.
Oh, I have too.
Exactly. And they could be, you know, forget the title for a moment. Who are the people?
I was going to say, and quite frankly, I've seen that more than I have for example, the C-level individuals. I've seen the rank and file leadership step forward more so, I think, over the past few years than I've seen something coming down from the executive suite.
And it's refreshing, right?
Oh yeah, no. And quite frankly, at the rank and file level, which is, you know, basically where, you know, I get down in the weeds to try to get some of this stuff done, it absolutely is refreshing. And most of those individuals go completely unnoticed except for the team that they're working within.
Yes.
They don't get any kind of corporate acknowledgement. I did an engagement for a very large multinational firm, and I had an individual that was basically working virtual with things in Houston while he was living in Maine, and it would be 9, 10 o'clock at night he would be working on stuff and calling me on the phone, but nobody ever acknowledged the fact that he was doing the things he was doing, which was basically keeping the enterprise out of hot water. You know, this kid was out there and it just took the bull by the horns and got right on with it. And it was refreshing. But, you know, the unfortunate flip side of it was he never really got the recognition other than from the team internally. But management never, at least to my knowledge, never acknowledged it.
Yeah. And I think there's a couple of lessons there. One is for the fellow in Maine, you know, or for me or for you or, you know,
right.
any of us kind of feel it's our own business, whether our name's on the door or not, it's at the end of the day, we really do have ourselves to account to and to look in the mirror and say, did I do my best? Did I, did I generate the offers and make the commitments and express the courage or live with courage that I feel good about? So that's one thing, because I'm going to feel better and my pay is going to be whatever my pay is going to be. I mean, we always want more, but so you got to figure out, you know, what makes
right.
sense in that regard. But do I feel good about what I accomplished and what I did and how I interacted today? The second lesson for me is for executives, for those who do it, managers and executives in organizations, that is already there in your organization. You don't have to. I had one guy, this was way back when, who said to me, there were two different divisions. He transferred from one, a manufacturing operation, transferred from one in one town to another a few hundred miles away. And he got to the new one, which was performing at a much lower level historically than the one he had just left. And he said, the problem here at this new place is that all these guys are apathetic, you know, and a bunch of whiners. And if I had all those guys from the other plant, at this plant, we'd be kicking butt.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I said, well, you know that's not going to happen, right? He said, I know, so I'm kind of stuck here. I said, why don't you create that here? And
yeah.
You know, we did. We partnered together and had some really good success. But when he recognized that it was up to him to create that, it wasn't something innate about the 300 people at this plant versus the 300 people at the other plant. And,
yeah.
You know, yes, there's always some bad apples. But there aren't 300 bad apples. There aren't 3,000 bad apples. There's a few everywhere. So you weed those out over time. But it's up to you as the leader of the organization, and you can, in very short period of time, you know, 60, 90 days, set a different tone for the organization.
You know, it's interesting. And I saw, you know, exactly what you're talking about in practice. Many years ago, I was doing consulting, like I mentioned, in the nuclear industry. And I was at this particular plant, and they got put on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's watch list, which
sure.
means that, you know, you've gone just about as far down the road, you know, messing things up as you can possibly get to if the government's going to tell you that you're on their watch list.
Right.
Well, so consequently, they canned this vice president. And the new individual that came on board happened to be a smoker.
Okay.
And because he was a smoker, his every hour, whatever, he decided to have a cigarette, he would go out, and there, of course, were the millwrights, the pipe fitters, you know, the electricians, you know, all the different trade guys and everything else. And he would quietly listen to these guys. And within 6 months, that plant was not only off the watch list, but it was one of the best running plants in the country. And it was simply because this guy got out there and mixed around, actually listened, and then started implementing what he was listening to, whereas the previous individual basically stayed in his office and was, you know, dictatorial, and it just kind of went from there.
Yeah.
So
I would bet that the guys, you know, the pipe fitters, millwrights, et cetera, also started to connect with him. And
oh yeah.
And trust got built.
He knew their first names. They weren't
exactly.
just another piece of blue collar labor that worked 8 hours a day or whatever. And you know, the interesting thing, Josh, is when time came for something would happen, and he needed some of these guys to actually go the extra mile to get something done, he didn't have to worry about it because they did it.
Exactly.
Because he had built that trust. You know, he knew who these guys were. He would throw them barbecues on Saturdays and come out there and flip hamburgers for these guys.
Yeah, it's not rocket science.
The interesting thing is, it's not rocket science, Josh, but for some reason, that message hasn't been tattooed on the forehead as a lot of these guys are coming out of graduate school or whatever. You know, they're just missing it. And a lot of the current leadership that I'm seeing aren't recognizing that they probably have, like we talked about a few minutes ago, those leaders already within their organization if they just open their eyes and look. And
yeah.
give them some opportunity to, you know, to shake the dew off their wings and actually take off.
Yeah. I think that, you know, for me there's a couple of things. There's one is that leaders don't anchor themselves in one of the principles of leadership, which is that relationship is the foundation for everything. And I don't mean just chummy relationship. I mean, if we don't have a relationship where we trust each other, then you're not going to go the extra mile for me.
Right.
If we don't have the kind of relationship where we can give each other honest feedback, including tough feedback, right? If you think I screwed up about something or vice versa, and we can't say that to each other, then we can't build something powerful together. And we need to have a relationship to the future or a relationship with the future that is one of ambition and inspiration rather than, as a fellow at one of these plants said to me, kind of going around introducing themselves and, you know, what do you do? And he said, you know, I can't remember how long I've been here, but I have 54 months to go. And I was just stunned by
yeah.
How could you come to work with 54 months to go. But he was saying it not like a joke. He was serious. I had this image of him, you know, ticking the boxes off on his cubicle every day. So people need a relationship with each other where they trust each other. People need a relationship with themselves where they're willing to take a risk. They're willing to be candid. They're willing to, act with some boldness. And they need to have a relationship with the future, which is one of ambition, inspiration, enthusiasm. I don't mean every minute. You know, we all get down in the dumps or, you know, things
right.
happen. But I mean, in general, we need to feel like we're building something and the future is going to be brighter. And that is the role of leadership, is to create that environment for people. And when you do that, it's
yeah, you know, it's extraordinary.
Yeah, great things can happen.
It's extraordinary. You've got a comment in here which I thought was pretty interesting, because this is something that I harp on a lot, and it's, are you your history or your future? You really have a choice. And I think people miss that very statement right there about you really have a choice. And I think they get anchored down on bad choices and don't realize that they can make a new one.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, it's one of these things where if you ask people, you know, what do you come to work for? And, you know, this one fellow said, I got 54 months to go. Somebody else said to me, you know, I consider work to be my 8-hour-a-day inconvenience. And somebody else said, you know, work is not a place where I go to do great things. But then you ask them, so tell me some things that you enjoy doing. And this person runs their church school or their church league. This person builds houses in their spare time. This person has I ran into somebody just 2 weeks ago who has this antique car collection, and they fix, you know, Corvettes and Porsches but at work, they're kind of a mouse, right?
Right.
Or it's drudgery. And it's just key what you said, which is we have a choice about how we are. We may not have a choice about, you know, we don't have a choice about what our boss is going to say to us, you know, in the next meeting. We don't have a choice about what our next paycheck is going to look like necessarily. You know, and many people are on, you know, are not independent contractors. So you know,
right.
you can predict very easily what you're going to make this year. But we have a choice about what we bring to the game every day. And we have a choice about whether or not we're going to speak up, you know, appropriately, obviously, and respectfully.
Right.
Or we can be sort of victimized by the situation. And I remember GE for a while had they kind of evolved their values over the years. But at one point, there was something about, you know, no victim mentality. So it was just unacceptable to be a victim of the situation. It didn't mean that from time to time there weren't really big problems and big issues that, you know, that you had to struggle with and had to deal with. But you couldn't wallow in that. You know, you couldn't just let that, you couldn't live in a chronic, persistent state of
complaining or
whining.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think people, and I see this a lot today, and I know this is probably a little bit off topic, but, you know, for example, the Occupy Wall Street group, you know, you have a bunch of college kids that went to school and got basket weaving degrees, and now they're pissed. You know, I don't blame them for being pissed for being $50,000 in the hole for getting a basket weaving degree, and there's no market for basket weaving.
Yes.
But the essence of what we just said was, you made a poor choice. Okay, make a new one. The opportunities, if you sit down and close your eyes and just let yourself become creative about what's going on and acknowledge the fact that, okay, so I boneheaded this one. Learn from it and move on, as opposed to, you know, sitting there constantly whining and complaining. And I think people are letting their choices anchor them and keeping them from making a different choice because they think the choice they made was, you know, that was it. And I try to remind people that, you know, baseball players don't bat 500. So that means if 50% of the time, you're either going to make a good choice or a bad choice. So, you know, just recognize that you're not going to make good choices all the time. You're not going to be 100% right ever, you know. So don't let it anchor you down. Don't let it, you know, don't let the fear of making a poor choice stop you from moving forward.
Yes, couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, in the context of leadership and running in organizations, you hear even very senior executives who are making, you know, very nice salaries.
Right.
Being kind of in a victim mindset about their industry or, you know, or the regulators or somebody, one of their peers. So I think it's at all levels. And,
oh,
and,
I agree. I mean, I see it across the board. That's why I kind of brought it up and wanted to bounce it off of you because, to me, you know, A, the fear of making an incorrect choice tends to lock people up, and B, if they make a poor choice, tends to be, it almost seems like it's catastrophic to them.
Yes.
And
it's catastrophic, and people forget, I think, or stop relating to it as a choice. They relate to it as a predicament and a hole that they can't get out of. You know, so that's you know, that's part of human behavior,
right.
Human mindset, and it's. I think from our perspective, the principle that we try and work with organizations with is that the future that you're creating has more influence on today's mood, spirit, and behavior than your history. And because people, you know, if history was great, then people kind of harp back and want to, they pine for the good old days. And if history was, you know, bad, if bad things happened, which, you know, good and bad happen to all of us, but
sure.
If they're kind of stuck with some of the bad things, then they're frozen by it and won't take a risk. Or won't reach out, or, you know, the sales guy won't go back to the marketing guy and try and resolve something because 2 years ago, you know, she or he got upset about something and they can't talk to each other anymore. I mean, you know, silly stuff, looking from the outside, but that's what happens in organizations. And when a leadership group can get together and carve out a bold vision of where they want to take that organization, all of a sudden, the past, the people don't, you don't forget the past, but you kind of put it, you're able to put it in its proper place, which is just like you said, oh, we tried that, it didn't work. That doesn't mean nothing like that could ever work. It means for whatever reason it didn't work, it didn't work. Now,
right.
What are we going to try going forward? And it becomes an enormously energizing because people are able to put the past in the past where it belongs. And like I said, not to forget about it, you know, and in fact, to learn from it and be, you know, to honor it, to respect it.
Oh, and, yeah, absolutely.
And then it's kind of amazing because you're actually empowered by your past, even if there were bad things that happened.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm where I'm at and I've got the scars to prove it, you know.
Exactly. And I'm better for those scars.
I am absolutely better for those scars.
I'm stronger,
but,
and, you know, like the saying, if it didn't kill me, it makes me stronger.
Right. So, God, the time's
gentlemen,
already gone.
Gentlemen, before it gets to me, we need the name of the book. People are asking, the book?
The name of the book. The name of the book is The Power of Strategic Commitment. And I'm sure they can find it.
On Amazon?
Yes, yeah, it's on Amazon.
And then we have one lady that's been holding on, and she has a question for you two gentlemen. And she says, I want to start my business. How do I select the right team?
There you go, Josh.
Well, the quick answer is you've got to get people that share your view of what you want to build, you need to do it based on alignment of vision. You need to do it based on competence. So you can't do it just based on friendship, because you can be friends with people who are not competent in certain arenas. And there's nothing wrong with that friendship, but, you know, I love my son, but he's not going to do my taxes.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he's 11. And you need to have it, and it needs to be people who have skin in the game, you know, who are passionate about the success of what you're trying to build and have something at stake. And that can be financial, or it can be reputational, or, you know, as many dimensions to what people have at stake. But those are, from my perspective, those are kind of the minimum requirements. And there's plenty of books out there that would give you, you know, more specific definition in terms of what industry you're trying to start out in, and many other things.
Right.
Dave, what about you? Any
I was gonna say, you know, one of the challenges that I always have is trying to hire the proper. It's trying to fit, like Josh said, fit a cultural puzzle together as far as a dynamic team. The first thing I truly look for is somebody that's smarter than I am. And it's somebody that augments my skills, because I'm not trying to duplicate what I want out there. I want to broaden the overall skills of the team. The other thing I look for is fearlessness. Like Josh and I were talking about, I'm looking for somebody that has, you know, scars on the back and successes and failures, and it doesn't define who they are. And it's a hard combination to find, and I usually go through a lot of people trying to find those skills. But the ones that have worked for me and with me over the years are absolutely that way. And the last piece is, you know, is the trust piece. Because you end up spending a lot of time with these individuals, and if they're, for example, if they're working for me at a client site, I have to trust that individual not only represents me, but represents the client and is there to, you know, actually polish the diamond and make it, you know, make it sing. So
that's great.
Well, we have one more question too. And this one's kind of a tough one, you guys. And I don't even know how to phrase it right, but it sounds like, how do you know when to call in an expert, and can you do that if you're not in senior leadership? In other words, if you're the guy that's pushing the broom and you notice that the company's going to hell in a handbasket, how can you make a suggestion that maybe they should call one of you guys and bring you in?
This is what I would do, Judy, and Josh, you can add to this, I'm sure, is I take the bull by the horns, and I have absolutely, of course it's me, I have absolutely no problem walking into somebody's office and explaining that you have a problem X, Y, and Z, and that it probably should be looked at, because, you know, your concern is that your department, your company, whoever you're working for, is not as good as it can be. And to get it better, whether it's training for the employees, different processes or whatever, that's the reason you're having that conversation. You shouldn't shy away from that. You should take it forward.
I like that angle, because if you can, you have to, you know, the person who's going to be able to bring an outsider in has to have some level of authority in the organization. So for someone without that authority, they have to approach someone with authority, but come in alongside of their commitment. So don't just come in with, hey, this is screwed up, and make it a problem for the manager. You have to come in and, like Dave said, position it as, I know that you are committed to us operating effectively and increasing our output or decreasing costs or whatever they're committed to. And I observe that there are things that are happening that are inconsistent with your commitment. I have some ideas about ways we, or about someone who could help us, be more effective at achieving what you're committed to. So you're approaching them with a solution to their problem, or a potential solution to their problem. And people are just that much more willing to listen than merely coming in with a complaint.
Right. I mean, you don't ever want to approach it just as a bitch session. You want to, you know, this is a piece of advice that I was given years and years and years ago, is if you go to senior management, go to them with a solution. Don't go to them with a problem.
And the solution may be a prospective conversation with someone who you think
right.
might be able to help.
Exactly.
Which is at least it's not just a complaint. It's a, you know, this might help us.
And Judy, I would also tell the listener that don't let a no or a disinterested manager stop the conversation. Be persistent about it, because you're doing two things. Number one, you're showing your level of concern for the organization you're in, and number two, you just never know where that conversation's going to go. And if it's a great, if it's a good, great idea, you don't want it to have die a silent death just because a disinterested manager turns you away.
That's great.
And that leads to the final point here. That of someone, how do they reach you? Is there a way to reach either one of you? Do you guys have websites?
Right. I was going to give Josh. Josh, you can give. I was going to say, Josh is at www.quantumperformanceinc.com, and that's all one word, quantumperformanceinc.com. That's correct, isn't it, Josh?
That's correct. Yep.
And you can reach me at info@campbellmanagement.us.
Sounds great. I think you guys have done some terrific stuff. And, you know, I'm excited as a person that's listening to this and the quality of the advice and the talent you guys have. It really sounds like you could be key to turning some of these businesses around that right now are floundering and are not sure whether to expand or contract or whatever. I mean, right now is such a critical point in businesses all over because nobody's sure which way to go. How would you ask them to stimulate ideas when people are feeling so depressed? I think Davey said that about the Reagan years were quite different from the Carter years, and I think we're finding the Obama
right.
malaise is worse than the Carter malaise.
I would agree somewhat, but the part of the conversation, and Josh, you can agree chime in on this, is I think the word responsibility and accountability, and Josh talked about it earlier, we need to embrace the fact that, you know, we're responsible for our attitudes. And, yeah, the economy is what it is and everything else. But you don't have to, just like we were talking about choices, you don't have to let that define where you're at. There's successes happening every day. They're not being talked about. They're not being celebrated, but they're out there. I mean, you know, the news is full of nothing but, you know, is tragedy after tragedy, because apparently that's what sells the news. They're not talking about the great things that are happening, but there are great things happening out there.
Yeah, I agree, and I think one of the things that I was working with several very large financial institutions over the last few years, and in the heart of the worst of it. You know, two-ish years ago, several of the senior executives that I was working closely with, rather than go and kind of hide in their offices and wait till the storm clouds passed, they were out with their people, talking to them, telling them, giving them as much facts as they could, rather than letting the rumors and the storm clouds kind of, you know, influence people's mood and thinking. And they told people what they believed needed to happen, how they could weather the storm, keep people focused. So we're never, you know, aside from momentarily, right, we slip into the pool and we're scrambling to get up. Aside from moments like that, we're never completely helpless. We can always reach out. We can always connect with people. We can always, you know, display some courage in our interactions in organizations. It's never done. And even, you know, places have gone out of business. And I mean, look at the auto industry. 2 years ago, it was dead. So there's, you know, the hope is, it's not about hope. It's about action.
Yeah, and it's about effort.
Yeah.
You know, it's about unmitigated effort.
Yeah.
And people, for some reason, and I've used this example before, Josh, is look at Dave Thomas. You know, he dropped out of high school at 15, built himself into a multi-millionaire, went back and got his GED from high school at 45.
Wow.
But that never stopped him. I mean, it's the same with Colonel Sanders.
Yes.
You know, Colonel Sanders was 67 years old when he got, you know, when he was making his secret recipe. But it's effort. You know, it's that old, you know, dig down, pull your socks up and get after it kind of effort that people need to understand that, you know, this level of dependency, and we talked about it again, Judy, on choices. You just can't let choices define who you are. I mean, everybody is capable of greatness, depending on what you want to define as greatness, but everybody has that capacity. They can't let some of these silly damn labels define who and what, you know, where they're at.
Agreed.
Hey, we got another person that wants to know what's the most successful story you have when you've been working with a client. If you've got one to share, they'd love to hear it. Don't be shy.
And can you hang for a few more minutes, Josh?
Yes, sure. You want to go first, Dave? Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I mean, this massive IT project that we were supporting, you know, 2.5 years, 2,500 people, $500 million, came in on time and under budget. And it was, you know, whether we played a 1-degree role or a 5-degree role, it doesn't matter. It was something where the setting the vision and getting people on the same page and supporting over time for people to, you know, stay clear about what they were trying to accomplish. It was Booz Allen gave them a 1% chance of success when they did the initial project analysis. So that was a nice success. There have been dozens. That was quite large scale. But I've seen, you know, like Dave said, you know, manufacturing plants that were 10th out of 10 in their organization, in their, you know, larger organization, in a matter of 9 to 12 months go to number one. And not because the others fell down, because they leapfrogged in terms of, you know, because they were aligned, they were trusting, they were clear about where they were headed. So those are just two quick ones.
Great. What about you, Dave?
I think the two that probably stick out just recently are probably the two mergers that I worked through, and, you know, very much like Josh indicated with Booz Allen. When I was able to pull them off, I had senior vice presidents come up and basically, you know, hand me the money in the pool that basically said I wasn't going to be able to get them done on time and under budget because everybody was betting against it. But I think probably the bigger success is the teams that I built have to this day followed me. If I have an engagement, all I have to do, and I'm a very, very lucky individual, is typically pick up a phone if I need to build out certain skill sets because we've built that kind of relationship. And it's beneficial for me because it means I can put together a team rather quickly that I trust and we all basically know, you know, where we're coming from and what we're trying to do. So it kind of shortens the timeline for me a little bit. I don't have to, you know, try to reinvent the wheel. But to me, that's the biggest success, is having my peers feel compelled, you know, to work with me. So
that's great.
Well, listen, Josh, it's been an absolute blister of an hour. It was great. I really, really want to thank you for coming on and talking about your book. And again, the book is The Power of Strategic Commitment. And I encourage everybody that's listening to, you know, when the show's over or even during the show, go out to Amazon and pick a copy of this up. It is a great, great book. It offers tremendous insights, not only from an organizational standpoint, but from an individual standpoint on how to stamp down a little bit of this mediocrity that we talked about earlier, and how to encourage not only yourself, but, you know, it maybe help encourage the organization to start getting themselves back in the direction that they need to go. And you can reach Mr. Liebner, as I said, at www.quantumperformanceinc.com. And again, thanks so much, Josh, for being a guest.
My pleasure, Dave. Great to talk with you.
Thank you, sir. So, Judy, do we have anybody else on?
We don't have anybody else on the line, but we have people in the chat room that still want to ask questions. One of the questions that bounced back was mediocrity. You had mentioned, I'm putting two of these things together.
Oh, that's fine.
You had mentioned something about how you thought mediocrity had something to do with the tone of the day, the political climate and the financial climate. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because that seems to have ginned up some interest here.
It's my opinion that a lot that's going on in Washington is a reflection of who we are. And the reason I say that is because 51 years ago, when John F. Kennedy said, ask not what, you know, the country can do for you, but what you can do for the country. And now all of a sudden, you know, we've got 40, almost 50% of the country wanting to know what the country can do for them, not just the opposite. So in the matter of half a century, we've gone completely opposite of being self-sufficient and everything else to being basically becoming more and more dependent, dependent culture. So,
what do you think from a management standpoint? How can you put those principles about solving problems on such a wide scale? I mean, when you mentioned that about 50% of the people are on the dole and now are thinking they can get something for nothing, and you started out with that horrible story about the Medicare scam where there are millions of dollars, people might used to think that that was horrible, and now they're probably saying, I wonder how I can get mine.
I'm sure that little piece of news, although I'm sure that, you know, the current administration is probably still dancing around patting themselves on the back, will probably have gotten lost in American Idol tonight or whatever reality shows on TV, because people, although I think they're becoming more engaged, are not fully engaged politically or with what's going on in this country. I mean, you have a whole incident of Fast and Furious that's been going on for I guess it's almost going on a year and a half since the border agent was killed because of that particular thing. And they're still parsing back and forth and bickering like little school children over the whole issue, when Daryl Issa basically should find Eric Holder in contempt of Congress and get on with it. But
absolutely.
It's that kind of lackadaisical kind of get along, go along that people constantly see, and they And after a period of time, I think they give up on it because they just don't think their, you know, their voice matters or anything else. And what disturbs me is the level of mediocrity seems to be growing. And what I'm trying to encourage people to do is take responsibility for their own mediocrity, recognize that maybe they've been complicit in some of this stuff, and understand that they can make a different choice, and that they're capable of greatness, and that they can actually move the ball forward. And I think if you get, you know, the country understanding that, okay, we made a poor choice, we're going to make make a different choice, we're going to do this, it'll move forward. And I'll give you another perfect example. We put up with the whole gas price situation. You know, I put up with it during the Carter years when we had gas lines, and at that time, my first wife, and yes, I've been married twice, my first wife worked for a gas distributor here in the city of Phoenix. And there was more gas stored in the city of Phoenix to the point where they were shipping gas out of state because they didn't have the storage here in town. Yet we were all in gas lines. People accept it. People accept what we have right now. And to me, that's mediocrity. There is no reason why the working class in this country, the consumer base in this country, accepts this. And by accepting it, we basically give them license to continue to do it. And I've always maintained that the consuming public, whatever that number is, 100 million, 200 million people, 150 million people, if the consuming public acted in unison, a lot of this would stop. You know, if they decided at some point that enough was enough, a lot of this would stop. But
I think there was a prime example, Dave, about when they wanted to monkey around with the internet and...
Exactly.
They all just said, no, we're shutting it down today, and see what it would be like if Facebook wasn't here, if Google wasn't here, if Wikipedia wasn't here. And they did it for one day, and that's all it took.
Interestingly enough, if we could get everybody together, say all the truck drivers and airline pilots, and just decided for the day that no airplanes and no trucks were going to move. Do you think somebody would get the message?
Yeah, absolutely. Where's their courage, Dave?
That's my point. See, that's my point. That courage goes hat in hand with the mediocrity piece. And, you know, it's what Josh was talking about. You know, you can change it. You have to change it individually, and then you have to work from there out. You know, it's just like, you know, dropping a pebble in a pond and watch the ripples move forward. But you got to drop the pebble in the pond, right? You've got to make the decision that you're going to be a difference. And it's like I said earlier, it's my belief that we all have greatness. Now, you can define greatness in a gazillion different ways, but we all have it. And to be anything less than that, to me is you know kind of just throwing the towel in and saying, you know, well, they beat me, you know. And what we were talking about earlier in the book is I think a lot of people are at that point. And I would say, you know, how do you fight mediocrity? Is you just don't tolerate it, you don't accept it. And, you know, you just put a stake in the ground. So I don't know if that answered the question or not, but
no,
I don't think we put that stake in the ground.
Right. I think one of the things that you guys were talking about that was so fascinating is that you really had to be future focused, and that you might learn from the lessons of the past, but not to use them as a weight or an anchor to drag you backwards, And
no,
I don't think that we have that goal setting anymore. I don't think people set goals. What would you tell people, again, going back to that gal that wanted to know about starting a business in this really bad economic time, how would you help people with goals, Dave?
Raise the bar. Raise your own personal bar as high as you can raise it. There's an interesting quote, and I'm a big Vince Lombardi fan, and I know you probably know that from my other radio show stuff, but Vince Lombardi, and this is really the essence of what we've been talking about, is we will pursue perfection. We most likely will not achieve it, but in the process, we will achieve excellence. And I think
Say that again. That was really profound. Say that again.
You and I will pursue perfection. We most likely will not achieve it, but in the process, we will achieve excellence.
Great.
And I think that's where each and every one of us is missing it, is we're not pursuing the perfection, and in not doing that, we have allowed this level of mediocrity to continue to slime its way into the culture, and it's permissive across everything. Washington's just a perfect big primordial pool of it. And I think, like I mentioned earlier in the show, I think Newt Gingrich, of all the presidential candidates, at least had the idea of bringing, a Six Sigma kind of process, a kind of, improve the quality kind of process into that environment. And I think if you really started putting some process controls around Washington, probably two-thirds of it would disappear. Because you would find that, most of it's redundant and, it's not necessary.
Well, and the other thing that Newt represents, at least to me, is that he has a vision. Like you were saying, where are you going? Where do you think you're going? Are you looking to the past? Everybody seems to be pointing fingers of blame at the past. And yet the only candidate that I hear that has a vision of where they're going is, drill here, drill now, $2.50 gas. Six Sigma, reforming the civil service code, reducing the taxes. I mean, those are things you can get excited about, and I see that as a terrific manager too. When you have somebody that challenges you to do that, you get excited and empowered, and you move forward versus this, mediocrity.
Exactly.
But that's
what good leaders do, right? Is they inspire.
Right.
And that inspiration. It's really, that's the essence of Josh's book is, inspiration. People can say what they want about Mitt Romney. People can say what they want about Rick Santorum. They're all, they're both great individuals. And believe me, I would vote for any of them. I'd even vote for the Aflac duck other than Obama. But the only one that I see that offers up what I would consider leadership and inspiration is Newt. Now, I mean, you can argue that he's got all of this baggage and this and that and everything else, but I would say, that's just like we were talking about, he's got the scars, he's got the experience.
Hey, that's a good point. He's battle-tested, isn't he? That's a really good point.
He's absolutely battle tested, and quite frankly, like I said, he's got the inspiration. The problem is, he's swimming upstream against an extremely well funded and an organization that probably doesn't want what I would consider inspiration. I don't think the RNC, because quite frankly, you get a maverick in the White House like Newt Gingrich, and I know we're way off topic here, but you get a maverick like Newt Gingrich in there, and all the bets are off because, you know, as we heard during the debates, you know, I took one for the team and so on and so forth. I think maybe the environment would change pretty significantly if this speaker actually did step into the Oval Office.
Well, I think what you were saying about mediocrity, don't you think that people kind of they are comfortable with that? I mean, don't you think that a lot of the reasons people don't risk or take chances because of the comfort zone?
Oh, sure. It's two things, Judy. One of it's fear of making a mistake, because a lot of people look at mistakes as catastrophic, and they're quite comfortable just floating in the stream, and you know they don't want anybody to interrupt their nachos and television. Unfortunately, I'm built a little differently than that. But, you know, and I don't fault them for it. You know, a lot of individuals have worked extremely hard to get where they're at. And, you know, quite frankly, they don't want to be bothered with a lot of things. You know, maybe they don't want to be bothered with having to make decisions and so on and so forth. And I can't blame them for that. Now, I can blame organizations like Washington for their mediocrity, because they're supposed to be entrusted with our money. And
they're representatives. They're supposed to represent.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the unfortunate thing is by us and our mediocrity, we've allowed them to become mediocre. And, you know, quite frankly, we're getting what we pay for. And I think, quite frankly, we need to raise the bar, and we need to raise it a lot higher than it is right now.
So so let's say that you get the opportunity to go in and shake up Congress.
Right.
What would you do with them? 535 people, what would you do? I mean, this is a great question for you. What would you do with 535, the people in Congress, what would you do? If you had a chance to go in and work with them, what would you do?
I would basically, and I've heard this before, I would basically eliminate every damn department that they have, that they've created and everything else. That would be start number one, besides, you know, killing Obamacare.
Yeah.
Because all of the departments that are in Washington are replicated across the states, right? So there really is no need for them. They're obviously, since 1970, when we created the EPA, it's done nothing but a stranglehold on the United States. And now it's encroached itself into the UN and everything else, and it's become, you know, this global mastermind of you know, controlling us through, you know, the water we drink and so on and so forth. But as far as I think what would need to happen is you get in front of the 435 people in Congress, and you know, you build a team to fix something. And if they don't want to, based on their political or their agendas or whatever, then they're dismissed. And you bring somebody else in. You know, you ought to have the ability just to fire their damn asses.
That's what elections are supposed to do.
I know what elections are supposed to do, but the problem is, you know, it's like we said in the joke earlier. You know, we end up with the golf course, and then when the campaigning's over, we end up with the garbage dump. You know, all of these guys end up doing is breaking our hearts, because, you know, they'll tell you one thing to get elected, and 15 minutes later, after they're having their power lunches on K Street, you know, that's the end of that. So.
Well, one of the best quotes I heard was Sarah Palin at CPAC, and she said They go to Washington claiming that they want to drain the swamp, and they get there and they turn the swamp into a hot tub.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah, it's pathetic. It's pathetic. But this whole thing of, and I really do almost believe that there's this mediocrity, go along to get along, you know, I'll scratch your back if you scratch my back, and, you know, don't shake up anything. And that's why I think that you have mediocre candidates, because they're afraid to shake up anything too. They don't want to upset the apple cart. They want the benefits. They want the lifestyle.
Absolutely. I mean, just look at it. Where do you get that kind of A power, prestige, salary, and you only have to work, 3 months a year or whatever it is? I mean, and then you only have
They're in session quite a bit, but they're also on airplanes and on
right.
trips
and then,
abroad.
You know, and then, you know, and then to collect their pension and benefits, they only have to be, I think, in office 6 years?
Mm-hmm. 6 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's a hell of a deal. Most people don't even get vested in a program unless they've worked at a company 5 years, you know, and that's not a full retirement package and everything else. You know, most working people have to do 20-plus years to get those kind of benefits. These guys get it in six.
It's crazy. I was going to say, why don't you promo next week's show? I can't even believe that this show, The Fastest 2 Hours in Radio, is almost over. So tell the audience what they can look forward to.
Next week we're gonna probably spend most of the 2 hours talking about Second Amendment rights.
Wow.
I have the owner of CTR Guns, who's actually, and in addition to the owner of CTR Guns, is an NRA instructor, concealed carry instructor, and everything else. And we're going to go over Second Amendment rights and concealed carry items and issues around gun control and everything else. So we're probably going to have a really fun 2 hours next week. The gentleman's name is Mr. John Webster, and it should be great. And then we've got, you know, a pretty strong lineup coming after that. So,
well, Dave, and again, you know, one of the things that people always want to know is if they have thoughts or they want to reach you or comment, can they reach you off air? Is there a place that
absolutely they can email me at info@campbellmanagement.us, all one word, campbellmanagement.us. They can also reach me at info@clarityfromchaos.com.
True that you have a blog? Is it true that you have a blog?
I have a blog. It's still under construction. So, in a couple of weeks, that's going to be up and going. You can also get me on Twitter. I'm at Campbell, capital G, capital R, capital P. .com. You can reach me at Twitter.
Are you on Facebook?
I don't have a Facebook page. I am on Facebook, just under Dave Campbell. So you can also reach me there. Go ahead.
If you have any comments out there, folks, and you find us, and a lot of people listen to the rebroadcast of the show, and if you missed the live feed, we encourage you to get in touch with Dave, and you know, let him know your thoughts about his show, and maybe make suggestions for future guests if you've got somebody that you think would be appropriate, or somebody that could also answer a question about management that could tangle with Dave. I think that would be a lot of fun. So, again, you've got his site, you've got his info, and, again, you can call us on our toll-free guest line, which
right.
is 1-877-572-1895, and join the conversation because we always enjoy that as well.
And remember, Yeah, the final thought is remember, life is not to patiently wait for the storm to pass, but it's learning how to dance in the rain.
Wow, wow.
I'd like to thank everybody, and we'll be here every Wednesday night from 7 to 9, and I look forward to hearing from you. Good night.
Good night, everyone. We'll take you out with some good music here.
You were dreaming on a park bench by the broad highway somewhere, when music from the carillon, it seemed to hurl your heart out there. Past the scientific darkness, past the fireflies that flow, to an angel bending down to wrap you in her warmest coat. And you ask, what am I not doing? She says, your voice cannot command. She says, in time, you will move mountains, and it will come to your hand. Still you argue for an option, still you angled for your case, like you wouldn't know a burning bush if it blew up in your face. Yeah, we scheme about the future as we dream about the past, when just a simple reaching out might build a bridge that lasts. And you ask, what am I not doing? She says, your voice.